Welcome to the First Unitarian Universalist Society of New Haven, a home for liberal religion for many years and a place where we're always pursuing the truth, but we're not always sure we have it sufficiently to bash others with it. I'm going to light the chalice. And as I do so, some opening words from Emerson, who said, "So nigh is grandeur to our dust, so near is God to man. When duty whispers low, thou must, the youth replies, I can." And now, will you join me in reading on the back of the program, the lower part? We'll read as a responsive reading this piece written by a man named Frank Scott, Villanelle for Our Time. From bitter searching of the heart, quickened with passion and with pain, this is the faith from which we start. Human beings shall know commonwealth again.
From the searching of the heart.
We love the easy and the smart, but now with keener hand and brain,
we rise to gain a greater heart.
The lesser loyalties depart, and neither race nor creed remain.
From the searching of the heart.
Not steering by the venal chart that tricked the mass for private gain,
we rise to gain a greater heart. Reshaping will, law, and art, whose symbols are the millions slain, from bitter searching of the heart, we rise to play a greater part.
And as a sort of a text for what I'm going to talk about later, I asked Gary to read a little piece about Bill Gates. This is from, I'm sort of being inspired today by this book. And also I read others by this author. This is his latest one, Liquid Modernity. He's a very challenging sociologist.
The sociologist Richard Sennett was for a number of years a regular observer of the worldwide gathering of the high and mighty, held annually in Davos. Money and time spent on Davos trips paid handsomely. Sennett bought from his escapades quite a few striking and shocking insights into the motives and character traits which keep the present-day top players of the global game on the move. Judging from his report, Sennett was particularly impressed by the personality, performance, and publicly articulated life creed of Bill Gates. "Gates," says Sennett, "seems free of the obsession to hold on to things. His products are furious in coming forth and is rapid in disappearing. Whereas Rockefeller wanted to own oil rigs, buildings, machinery, or railroads for the long term, Gates repeatedly announced that he preferred positioning oneself in a network of possibilities rather than paralyzing oneself in one particular job." What seems to have struck Sennett most was Gates's unashamed, outspoken, even boastful willingness to, quote, "destroy what he had made, given the demands of the immediate moment," unquote. Gates appeared to be a player who flourishes in the midst of dislocation. He was cautious not to develop attachment, and particularly a sentimental attachment, or lasting commitment to anything, including his own creations. He was not afraid of taking a wrong turn, since no turn would keep him going in one direction for long. And since turning back or aside remained constantly and immediately available options. We may say that, except for the widening range of accessible opportunities, nothing else was accumulating or accruing along Gates' life track. The rails kept being dismantled as soon as the engine moved a few yards further. Footprints were blown away. Things were dumped as quickly as they were put together and forgotten soon after. Mm.
Okay, I'd like to read a poem by William Carlos Williams. It was published in 1935 and makes some oblique reference to this environment of the Depression, I think. It's called The Yachts. Williams was a pediatrician in Rutherford, New Jersey, and he doctored for 50 years, and in that time he also wrote 50 books, which he wrote between about 12 midnight and 2 in the morning. And then he was in his office at 8 the next morning, so he was a formidable character. And he took some time off, though, and went to a sailboat race one day, or a regatta, or whatever you call it. The yachts contend in a sea which the land partly encloses, shielding them from the too heavy blows of an ungoverned ocean, which, when it chooses, tortures the biggest hulls. The best man knows to pit against its beatings and sinks them pitilessly. Moth-like in mist, scintillant in the minute brilliance of cloudless days, with broad bellying sails they glide to the wind, tossing green water from their sharp prows, while over them the crew crawls ant-like, solicitously grooming them, releasing, making fast as they turn, lean far over, and having caught the wind again side by side, head for the mark. In a well-guarded arena of open water, surrounded by lesser and greater craft, which, sycophant, lumbering, and flitting, follow them, they appear youthful, rare, as the light of a happy eye, live with the grace of all that in the mind is fleckless, free, and naturally to be desired. Now the sea which holds them is moody, lapping their glossy sides, as if feeling for some slightest flaw, but fails completely. Today, no race. Then the wind comes again. The yachts move, jockeying for a start. The signal is set, and they are off. Now the waves strike at them, but they are too well made. They slip through, though they take in canvas. Arms with hands grasping seek to clutch at the prows. Bodies thrown recklessly in the way are cut aside. It is a sea of faces about them in agony and despair, until the horror of the race dawns, staggering the mind, the whole sea become an entanglement of watery bodies, lost to the world, bearing what they cannot hold. Broken, beaten, desolate, reaching from the dead to be taken up, they cry out, failing, failing, their cries rising in waves still as the skillful yachts pass over. Under erasure, the loss of irrevocable life decisions under the regime of liquid modernity. What does that mean? I'm glad you asked. it's actually quite a task to try to take the thinking of a sort of original and profound thinker who's thinking about what our society is really about, and try to compress this into something that can come across and not distort what he's saying too much. But you heard me reading about Bill Gates, and he could be taken as sort of the arch hero of liquid modernity. He's a surfer. He stays standing when everybody else is falling down, or he's sort of like one of these yachts. You know, the yachts are in this completely liquid environment, but they prevail. Well, many others do not prevail. So we could contrast this with tradition, with a time when there was more tradition. Feudalism, for example. If you may remember in King Lear, Lear asks his three daughters to tell how much they love him, and the two older daughters they're modernized, so they realize you have to sell yourself, and they do a heck of a job. And then Cordelia gets up and she says, according to my bond, no more and no less. And so Lear disinherits her because he feels she doesn't love him. Well, the thing is, what she meant was that, well, I have a place in the hierarchy of beings, and I'm in the society that's established, and I have a role to play, and I will play it. And I will love my father as is appropriate, no more and no less. Well, that's the traditional idea. And these were irrevocable commitments. Another one that comes to mind is a person in the 20th century who had one foot in the Middle Ages, namely C.S. Lewis, the English literary scholar, really a respected scholar in literature. But he also was a late theologian, and as you know, the author of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe?
The whole series of
fairy tales. He also wrote adult fairy tales. Well, there's a movie about him, about how he was a bachelor for many years, and he fell in love when he was in his 50s. And the woman he fell in love with was Jewish, and she had cancer. So she had two strikes against her, but, you know, comes along.
She was an American.
And divorced, an American. But the thing is, we know it was real because it's a case of, you know, comes love, nothing can be done. And so they married. And Lewis drew out of his knowledge the vows that he wanted them to use, which they used. And they came from the Book of Common Prayer as it existed prior to the Edwardian reforms of around 1922, I think, when the King Edward. And he used this, which was apparently somewhat gives the lie to our view of the Victorians, because apparently they didn't have a problem with it. But as things went on, people started having a problem with it. And the vow went, with this ring I thee wed, with my body I thee worship, and with all my worldly goods I thee endow. So this shows Lewis's nostalgia for irrevocable life commitments. Now, of course, I'm not saying that people can't still make a commitment like that. My argument will be that in the world of liquid modernity, there's no support for this in the world around you, because everything else is in motion.
What is modernity?
Well, it just means the culture of modern times, basically. The culture and the type of society, the type of economy. Also, I could point to another aspect of this is that we could talk about heavy modernity, which would be like early industrialism, building bridges, you know, oil wells, heavy stuff, kind of stuff that's referred to in the thing about Gates, where Rockefeller had all this. When you were well up, you had heavy stuff. A good example would be the factory that Henry Ford built in Dearborn, Michigan, which was 3/4 mile long and 2/5 mile wide. And the raw materials went in and the cars came out, and everything was in that one building. And many thousands of people worked there. And you remember the famous story of how Ford doubled his workers' wages, which he said was for humanitarian. No, he said it was so they could buy his cars. The actual reason was he wanted to impose golden handcuffs on all of them because he had too much worker turnover. So the whole idea in the earlier phase of modernity was hold people in their places. So you could say that people were embedded in their place in society in the Middle Ages. And then along comes the French Revolution and the building of the factories in Manchester and England, and what, you know, Marx said in 1848, all that is solid melts into air. But the thing is, after you had been disembedded, there were new beds that you could be embedded in. And they were in good supply. So you became embedded in the Ford factory, and you were there for life. And if you joined the union, you were in that for life. So in this stage, in other words, before we could say things speeded up and computers really took over and what we have now, you lost your traditional orientation, but you had something new to orient to that was solid and stable. So conformity took the place of traditional identification. But in this new era of liquid modernity, or light modernity, anything goes and twinkle your toes. And speed is power. Whereas in the past, the rich people, the dominant people, had a castle they stayed in, or they had a big mansion near the factory which they owned. And the workers, too, were tied to that. It was like a marriage between the owners and the workers, and the owners were on top, and they stayed. And then, of course, some people were moving. The workers might have had to journey somewhere else to get a job and so on. This has now been reversed. So you now have a very small elite that are totally mobile, totally detached from any kind of a place. You know, these are the people that own six mansions in six countries. And you get this feeling of this Bill Gates quote that they have become so fast that they're always ahead of all the people that are still stuck in place, which is most people. I mean, we can move, but it's a project. But they're in motion all the time. So there's this swirling motion, everything's in movement, and it's sort of like, you know, the embedding thing, it's like musical beds now. So I just thought we could take a look at a couple of things as a starting point here. You could take what I said about C.S. Lewis. But another way that people try to hang on to the sense of irrevocable commitments in life, which is something giving your life stability, was by through religion. And here I have a book which is called A Benediction of Place, Catholic Historic Sacred Sites of Kentucky and Southern Indiana. It was published a few years ago. And I want you to look at this picture, which is on the top right hand, page 141, in which you will see a group of young women entering the Dominican order and taking their vows. And take a good look at that. So just not to take up too much time, I'll tell you what it is ahead of time, but you can still look at it. They're wearing bridal gowns. And the notation says this was often done at that time. And of course, the nun becomes the bride of Christ. But they underlined it. I mean, personally, I find it a little shocking. It's an offering of their sexuality, they're giving up what is considered by most people to be the normal road to a happy life in order to do this other thing. And these vows are, you know, for life, as of course marriage vows are as well.
I was probably more so for them.
Well, of course, as we know, then, you know, after Vatican II and with basically the rise of liquid modernity, many people left the order and they did, and many other things happened. So the, what I call the dissolving acids of our time affect, you know, and you know, there's actually a high rate of divorce in the Bible Belt, higher than there is, say, again, where we live. In the liberal Northeast, there's less divorce than there is in the Bible Belt. And we could speculate on why that is.
Less church attendance also.
In the Bible Belt?
Really?
Less church attendance in the Bible.
That could be. That could be. So we might take as one more sort of exhibit on this, Jean-Paul Sartre, the philosopher that probably most of us have heard of, who sat in a cafe in Paris during the war and wrote his first major work, Being and Nothingness, and became famous after the war as the atheistic existentialist. And he said, basically, we are condemned to be free. We're living in a world of matter and motion, determined by chance, and there's no meaning given. In other words, there's no God to give us meaning, and nature doesn't give us meaning either, because we're not really part of nature. We're sort of in this state of, you know, consciousness doesn't really fit in to the world somehow. And so there's a void, but we could save ourselves from meaningless and futility by embracing a life project. So even though you might recognize that Such choices are arbitrary. Nevertheless, if you stick to your guns and maintain your commitment to your project, come what may, your life will be meaningful. I might be simplifying a little here.
Yeah. Just a little.
Well, I do think, though, there's the element of the heroic individual is still there. And so you can take arms against the sea of futility and prevail. But I think this is now archaic, because every commitment is under erasure from the get-go. That's a term I'm borrowing from the philosopher Derrida, somebody I don't really understand. So I might be giving it my own meaning. But you could imagine somebody, you know, if you wrote your name down in pencil and then somebody erased it, but if you look carefully, you could still see it. So we're living in a world where all our concepts are under erasure, meaning we've taken it from the air before everything became liquid. And we still are obliged to use these same concepts, just that we have to use the same language that is available. But they're all as though they've already been erased, but we use them anyway, because we don't have any choice. So it's sort of like the ghost of meanings past that we're living with. Another way of expressing this is that we are surrounded by zombie institutions. They look the same, but actually they're dead. But we don't have anything else, so we have to make do. So we're still condemned to be free, but in a world of liquid modernity, we lack the power as individuals to hold our lives together around our project. And the reason is everything else is in motion. I was loyal to the company, but it went bankrupt and I lost my pension. I was playing the game to the best of my ability, but someone changed the rules in the middle, throwing my life strategies into disarray. Society itself has now decreed that there is no such thing as society. I mean, think about this. The Prime Minister of England says there's no such thing as society. She occupies a position of authority within society. That's why she's the Prime Minister. So just as you're condemned to be free because you're in a world that has sort of pulled the rug out from under you in terms of these. Could we have questions after? Hopefully I'll get through this in time. I have more time for discussion. Well, I have to say I'm sort of just getting started here. So you're condemned to be, in other words, your society's saying, here's the game, now play it, and then they take away the things you need to play the game. It's sort of like when the children of Israel were making the bricks, and then the Pharaoh said, take away the straw, they have to get their own straw now. So, you know, you in other words, you make it almost impossible. So you make your vows if you so desire, but do not expect anyone else to regard them as binding and sacred. The past is gone. This is one of my fundamental assertions I want to make, that the past is over with. So do not engage in empty sentimentality. We have been shorn of our capacity to define ourselves, to choose who we shall be, in a world in which all such choices are now temporary and until further notice. And even language itself is an ever-changing matrix of meaning which we can't control as individuals. So we're free in principle, but we lack the power to make it stick. Bill Gates and Donald Trump are the heroes of this time, master surfers on the seas of liquid modernity. And I think we could probably add Barack Obama to that. Devious shapeshifters, ever resilient, always one step ahead of the game. You think you are ready to play chess with these masters who see instantly in their mind's eye the ramifications of each move in the game through the next 25 moves? You are overmatched. You will sink beneath the waves, still under erasure until the very end of your biological life. The only meaning possible is to buy products, put on the latest fashions, knowing they are but for the day. Embrace the latest intellectual fad, then let it go, for God's sake. Play the game as best you can, for it is the only game in town. As an example of a life choice that has been removed from the rule book, consider farming. The commitment to become a husbandman, married to a particular piece of ground, has been canceled. Whether by Stalin's collectivization of farming and extermination of the backward kulaks, or by Earl Butts and Monsanto through corporate control of the land, farming as a way of life is no longer possible as a life choice. Do not go there. Don't even think of it. It's over with. Commitment is folly. The system of rewards and penalties set up in our late capitalist consumer society forces us to travel light and avoid long-term covenantal relations. We're using the word covenant to mean a relationship that has a sacred dimension. And Cordelia was still medieval. She didn't get this. She didn't realize that in the new times you must actively sell yourself. Otherwise, contracts are sufficient for our needs as roving entrepreneurs of the self. Although, truth be told, they are fragile things upon which to rest one's hopes. Trust has been replaced by policy. Kudos to Shula. The covenantal relation in which one promises from the heart and gives one's whole self in the relationship has been replaced by contract. When one's spouse throws one away like yesterday's newspaper, one becomes adult and alone in a new way. William Carlos Williams said, divorce is the type of modern knowledge. It's not just this one covenant between this man and this woman, but the very possibility of any real binding and sacred covenant commitment crumbles away. The right to cut your losses and move on is the crucial right which today's society honors and supports, at least if you're one of the right people. Marriage and family as systems of survival no longer enjoy the support of society in the way that they did in an earlier time. So you're on your own. Suck it up. Get used to it. And after Katrina, we realized the government isn't going to rescue us either. Welfare has been abolished. Welfare was a commitment made during the now obsolete days of solid modernity that government would put a floor under the workers so that they could only fall so far through the cracks in the economy. And this has now been canceled. For some reason, all the people that are so vigorously in favor of this, that are workers, don't seem to realize that they're next. You know, living with no floor, no safety net, is no joke. Because you're in this world of complete fluidity, so you don't know what's going to happen next. So I say that in a world of liquid modernity, we see a whole civilization building a bridge to nowhere. It's a dead end. The molecules are all vibrating independently. All bonds of one molecule to another are so fragile, so temporary, that nothing solid or lasting can be built. Our life condition is thoroughly precarious. Whatever spiritual shelter we find, we are constantly reminded, is a product of our own individual choice and imagination. Now, I know Terry's going to object to this next part, but please hold it. Don't leave. Once a Catholic, always a Catholic, no longer obtains. One remains a Catholic only through constant vigilance, vigorous reaffirmation of one's daily choice to be a Catholic. It is all really quite arbitrary. Nothing stays put. Every morning you rise to find the household gods cast down from the altar and scattered on the floor. Every day you must put them back in order. If one day you are too tired and depleted to perform once again this work of reconstruction, then the altar vanishes from your life, its mental space immediately filled by the eternal noise of the marketplace and the media in this advertising age. One set of images is equal to any other. To insist so too strongly on the elevation of one image, say that of Christ or perhaps of Karl Marx, is to veer toward the forbidden territory of fundamentalism and idolatry. Business, business, uber, all this. This is the only remaining viable possibility. Endless progress, endless stuff. Only there is a problem. This devouring monster of progress now bids fair. Maybe I should say, by the way, this whole thing of liquid modernity has to do with considering ourselves to be commodities. It's because we now take the commodity as the image as a sort of type of a real thing, and we see ourselves as commodities. So that's why I see it that this is all part of progress and more stuff, and we're part of the stuff now. This devouring monster of progress now bids fair to eat up the world. Further progress required us to burn the ship itself as fuel. The disintegrating tendency of liquid modernity now leads us to a free-for-all to grab the last of the raw materials as Marduk-like. We chop up the body of Mother Earth and convert her into product. In the process, we are dissolving back into nature. Sinking beneath the waves, we are liquefying ourselves. So here's some more bracing words from Emerson. In an age of fops and toys, wanting wisdom void of right, who shall nerve heroic boys to hazard all in freedom's fight? So the question is there a way to recover these commitments? The whole thing I didn't have done put in here is about promises and how through a promise you gain some kind of control over what's going to happen to you. It's because I made this promise and the other person is in the promise with me that the world is not a chaos. It's become ordered in a certain way that I do have a bit of control over. So, in an age of fops and toys, wanting wisdom void of right, who shall nerve heroic boys to hazard all in freedom fight? Who indeed would have the nerve? Why sacrifice yourself when nothing lasting can be built anyway? The only law is the law of the East Colony. Any attempt to hold one's identity stable is mere nostalgia, a quaintly naive failure to notice that whatever stability remains is fast slipping away. 2 years ago, Leonard Cohen said, from where I sit, all the old landmarks are washing away. Circumstances and talent may not give you sufficient power to build anything. You are legally free to do so, but you lack the means. The race begins. The ardent young athletes line up. The gun sounds and they're on. But the ground is rough and strewn with hazards. Hardly has the race begun when several are down and out. A twisted ankle due, no doubt, to lack of conditioning or a pulled muscle. One young woman falls hard on sharp stones and suffers severe lacerations and bruises. But the pack moves on at speed with no time for so much as a backward glance at the fallen. Those who fall are but a lesson and a warning to those who must needs continue, giving their all to their great pursuit of the little rabbit of happiness that scoots along ahead of them. We live in a time of the complete privatization of human aspiration. As a result, it is harder and harder for people to get together on any arrangements, any common action that has any purpose other than supporting and encouraging the athletes of progress and individual achievement as they pursue their own private good. Republican government worked fairly well as long as we could still draw on reserves of tradition and cultural memory of the common good. But we are like fish in a pond that is being slowly drained of tradition. The old communities are gone. Community is a theme park we would all like to visit and do from time to time in various ways. But the real thing is no more. Now our utter poverty and loss has become apparent to us, and a new task presents itself, something beyond private gain, but there's no way to get there from here. Individuals who are deeply convinced that they are responsible for their own happiness, that they alone have the job of constructing a life, cannot agree on a common goal. One must serve God for himself alone, it was said in the past. One cannot use God as a means to the ultimate end of one's own individual happiness. Indeed, it is likely that finding salvation is actually a liberation from the arduous, incessant, and lonely labors of pursuing happiness. In feudalism, you could swear loyalty to the duke or baron you served. In tribal times, the life and well-being of the tribe had an absolute claim on the individual. The meaning of one's life was as a part and of and participant in the life of the tribe. Life outside the tribe was inconceivable. That would be soul death. To enter holy orders was to renounce all claims on building a life. Holy obedience took the place of individual responsibility for one's own happiness. In loyalty to what was considered a higher value, people in the past were free of the demands of pursuing happiness as individuals. In modern times, we have undergone the contrary liberation. We are free of tradition, free of higher values, treaty of obedience to a sovereign who was a sacred person, that is, a king. There are no more kings except in fairy tales. Only business remains, including the heavy business of becoming happy under our own power. Prozac, anyone? I have said that the past is finished and gone. We cannot go back to the world we have shredded. But perhaps there is still a way to escape our life sentence, condemned to be free. That is, to decide for ourselves in a game where we lack sufficient knowledge and experience to choose wisely, and where the whole field continually shifts and changes unpredictably. There is a factor of reality which we have not considered and which changes everything. That factor is fate. I'm doing a quick change here now. This is like a poem, so it doesn't necessarily have a linear thing. All people working separately toward their separate and diverse ends have nevertheless collectively and unconsciously produced certain results. These results, although in retrospect they appear inevitable, were unintended and for the most part unanticipated. These results together form the fate which now awaits our species. Result number one, we have overpopulated the earth according to any kind of norms of population biology. In other words, if you look at humans, and here in the U.S., we have alienated our own productive capacities as we pursued happiness in the role of consumers, leaving us dependent on nations that are at an earlier point in the curve of industrial development, who may well cut us off if we lose the big stick of our military superiority. The fate which is coming upon us because of these factors is poverty. Once we have become poor again, once the terrors of our historical fate have imposed this new poverty upon us, the bite of necessity will cancel the modern axiom, that is, the pursuit of one's individual happiness will no longer be acceptable as the fundamental maxim of human social life. The needs, the urgent necessities of the group will supersede our individual wishes. A new meaning will appear on the horizon given by the gods of history. Service to the group will no longer present itself as an admirable choice available to the few who insist on an earnest commitment to traditional values in a world where all can see that the pond of tradition has been drained dry. No longer will we be condemned to create and invent our own meaning through risky individual choices. No. Once again, meaning will be given. It will seem utterly obvious and objective. The meaning of human life will be service to the community and care of the earth upon which the life of the community depends. Those who pursue their individual ends will be condemned as antisocial. Those who pollute the waters will be held accountable. The authority of society will no longer support the sanctity of business, of contracts, of property, because something more basic will be at stake. Once again, the earth, the sky, and the gods will appear as sacred. These will be the obvious truths, the givens of a new era. Givens! The age of ecological Armageddon, based on the individual's unrestricted pursuit of happiness, will be seen in retrospect as an age of aberration and madness. All this will not happen as a matter of individual choice. Just as in our own time, the right of one partner in a marriage to dissolve that union and split the family apart has been deemed more precious than the preservation of the vows that founded the family or the strategy of survival that marriage once represented. I'm just saying, I'm not necessarily saying this that I disagree with the freedom of divorce. I'm saying that if you just look at the facts, before the 1970s, there was no such thing as just deciding that this marriage is over. You had to have reasons, because the community insisted that that was a social unit, and you had an obligation to the community, you know, and it was much broader than two people. So that was a choice, a change that happened, and what I'm arguing is that there will be a change in this era to come in which it will become self-evident that we will all hang together, or we shall all hang separately. will be delivered from many an agonizing choice by a poverty that will admit a few options. And I say this is our fate. I don't know how many of us will live to see this, how far it's going to unfold. But the maxim, I'll get mine, will be replaced by the maxim, all of us or none. So perhaps the only choice that remains for us now is whether we will welcome a new world now dawning with all its rich possibilities of profound connection and sacramental participation, or whether we will instead resist tooth and nail, clinging to our prerogatives as individuals, no matter how much damage such clinging will impose on the future of humans on the earth. And needless to say, all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others. And so they will have, some people will have more of an effect on these things. And now we're going to have a postlude, which I used before one time, and by way of the grapevine, I heard that some people really had a hard time understanding why I would use this particular song. Tennessee Waltz is a song about loss. On the literal plane, it's about a guy who loses his sweetheart, and that's potentially devastating. But then Leonard Cohen added an extra verse, which takes it to a whole different level of something really dark. So I see it as that we're losing something more, exactly what it's, it could be many things, how we could say it many different ways, but I guess it's sort of like losing faith in, or you're losing your sweetheart of America, let's say, as some of us grew up believing in America. And what, and I don't just mean our own individual country, but the whole idea of America, which has spread to the whole world now. So if we're heading toward our fate, anyway, so I think we need to feel this. I think this is a terrible block to us to move ahead. That we just don't want to feel how painful the losses are that we're really looking at.